ladies and gentlemen, wonderful to see you here. We are on number four. Is this right? We're on the fourth time we've met. Is that correct? Which is four out of six. Four out of six of the first term of McGinnis-Esther. McGinnis-Esther is so global. We've got so much to discuss tonight. It's more global than Rus. Rus is talking about the development of certain people which led to the Messianic line, which is, of course, vitally important. But this is about all of Klal Yisrael. And tonight we're going to jump straight into the discussion about why this happened at all. Why Purim happened. And we've just finished, I think, verse 8. And now we're about to get to verse 9. So before we get to verse 9, which is 1-9, I need to go through some concepts with you so that we're up and running from the get-go. So I'm now basically, I'm in between verse 8, about to do verse 9. But before I get to 1-9, I've got to do a three-way machlokes, a three-way dispute as to what's going on regarding Purim. And that will then get us all set up for verse 9. For I hear the most important, most maligned person in all of the Megillah that nobody talks about enough was Vashti. She wasn't just some queen that had to be pushed. She is a key player in all of this. And we have to understand her role, who she was, what was going on. She triggered the whole thing. So we must understand what's going on. People just think Vashti refused to come and dance and therefore he killed her. That opens the door for Esther. Let's get on with the meat and potatoes. No, Vashti's key. So let's try to talk about what's going on with Purim in general. Build up to Vashti. Then verse 9 is talking about Vashti. Verse 10 is talking about Vashti. Verse 11 is talking about Vashti. Verse 12 is talking about Vashti. And we need to know what's going on in a whole block of all these psukim about her. She's an important person on the horizon now. Let's jump straight into the Gemara Megillah Yud Beis Amud Aleph, which is what I quoted you last week. The Gemara Yud Gimel. And it says, the Chazal reply, basically, Chazal are giving us three separate reasons why Purim had to happen. I think you probably remember some from last week. Let's just go through it. The Gemara in Megillah said that it was because the Jews bowed to the idol in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And that's the reason espoused by the Talmidim of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, or Rav Shimon bar Yochai himself, in Gemara Megillah 12a, Yud Beis Amud Aleph. Okay? That was reason number one. Reason number two. Rabbi Yisachar of Kfar Medani in Medrash Esther Rabbah, 725. And the Targum all say it was because of the sin of the brothers selling selling Yosef, dipping the coat in blood and showing Yaakov the response. Yaakov then sits and mourns. They sold Yosef for money. They duped their father Yaakov. That was the Mechiras Yosef. That's wrapped up in this. And we started talking about the very end of last time. Other statements in Chazal, which is the Talmidim of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, again in Gemara Megillah, Yud Beis, states that no, the reason was that the Jews were benefiting from Achashverosh's banquet, most notably the idolatrous wine. The idolatrous wine was really bad. That was worse than the tray for food because it was akin to doing Avodah Zarah itself and harked back to the first reason, which is bowing down to the idol in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, just three generations prior. Yeah? Okay. The Talmidim of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai looked into all of these reasons, and they thought that the most important reason was the eating at the feast. That's what they concluded. They concluded that the most important out of those three was the eating at the feast. Now, Let's really take stock of the situation and try to understand what's actually happening so that we can really go forward in Megillas Esther with a good picture of what's really going forward. You've got to have this before you get to Vashti. Before you get to Vashti, you've got to have this clear. That's how important Vashti is. If you don't get these ideas clear, you won't understand Vashti's point in it. If you want to assume that Klal Yisrael were punished for worshipping the idol in Nebuchadnezzar's time, which seems to be Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's poise, and that God was allowing a significant amount of time, 3 generations, to go by for teshuva. He wants them to repent for bowing down to that idol. And then they failed to do so. The students turned round to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and said, isn't that a case of favoritism? God showing, look, if they're guilty of idol worship, punish them there and then. What are you doing waiting for 3 generations, hoping they'll do tshuva? You're treating them in an unequitable, non-legal way. Just if they're wrong, they're wrong. We say that the Jews actually never deserved annihilation. And the troubles they experienced, listen to these words. Listen to these words of Chazal. The troubles they experienced at the time of Megillas Esther was only to terrify them into thinking they would be annihilated. It's Chazal's statement. Purim was never going to happen. It was all a charade. It was there to literally scare the living daylights out of every single Jewish man, woman, and child. They're going to be killed. And that's what God wanted to do. Why on earth would that be the answer? When the Jews bowed down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar, why were they bowing down to it? Because they were scared that if they didn't, he'd throw them in a furnace. Which is what he did to the Hanan, Mishael, and Azariah, who didn't bow down to it. He chucked them in a furnace. And a nace happened, and the archangel Gavriel saved them. Right? That's the story in Daniel. But that means, would you think, don't answer me the question. I'm just asking. Ask yourself. If someone came along and literally had a burning furnace in front of you and said, anyone who doesn't do this is going to be chucked alive in the furnace, how would you feel about bowing down to the idol? Don't answer the question. Just a thought. When the Jews did bow down to the idol, which they did, they weren't doing it because they were worshipping another god. They were doing it because they didn't want to be thrown into a furnace. That's all. It wasn't as if they were actively doing Avodah Zarah. Yes, it looked externally that they were doing Avodah Zarah, but they weren't in their heart doing Avodah Zarah. They were just trying to save their lives. Okay, what about Yehari Gal Yavoi? It's one of the 3 things. Avodah Zarah is a bit of a problem. You should give up your life, etc. Okay. But the point was, is that when they did the Avodah Zarah, it wasn't with a full heart. What did God do? He scared the living daylights out of the Jews with a gezeirah to destroy them. But just like the Jews didn't mean to worship the idol, God never really meant to kill them either. You hear this? In the time of Nebuchadnezzar, when they were bowing down to the idol, they were bowing down without kavanah, but physically they were bowing down. In the time of Esther, there was gezeirah to kill all the Jews, but deep down there was no kavanah to kill the Jews. Measure for measure, it was a fix. Just like you bowed down to an idol to leave me en masse for another god, but I know deep down you didn't mean it. So I'll decree your gezeirah for destruction, and it'll look like you're going to be destroyed, but deep down I don't mean it. Do you believe what's happening? Do you hear what's happening here on a divine system? It's a midah keneged midah outcome for the bowing down to the idol. You didn't bow down in full throw to the idol. I won't destroy you in full throw. But it'll look pretty bad. Just like it looked pretty bad that you bowed down to the idol. Do you hear this? The disciples of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who were no slouches, disagreed with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And they said it wasn't the bowing down to the idol which triggered this. It was the eating of the feast. They said that Mordechai, who had Ruach HaKodesh, Ruach HaKodesh is one of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, one of the men of the Great Assembly, urged Esther to endanger her life by asking her to go and have an audience within 30 days of her previous audience. Now, you could go have an audience. It's okay for the queen to have an audience, but not more than once a month. And if you walk in before a month has passed, it's death. And there were still 11 more months before the decree was to be executed anyway. What's the rush? Why take the risk? If you know this thing's not going to happen for almost a year and you've only got a few days to wait, why are you forcing Esther to fast for 3 days and then walk in gaunt, not looking her best, risking her life? Why would Mordechai say, you've got to go now? You've got to go now and do this. A good reason is, I've got 11 months. Let me wait 15 days. I'll go in next month when I'm allowed to anyway. And without risking my life, I'll just go and save all the Jews. Do you hear that? Do you hear the point? He's putting her in a life and death situation, seemingly unnecessarily. He was imbued by Ruach HaKodesh. He knew by divine decree he had to do this. He told her, you've got to risk your life. She listened to her Rav. The Talmidim of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai knew the fear which overtook Mordechai was divinely inspired. And while fasting and dressed in sackcloth and ashes and crying bitterly in the streets, begging people first of all not to go and then begging people to do tshuva, he went round saying, now's the time to act only, we can't wait. Esther Rabbah 7:13 says, a letter for the destruction of the Jews had been written before God by the Sotan. You know, the Sotan went during this, unbelievable. During the actual time of the party when the Jews are drinking the wine, Sotan, you know, he flies up and he puts on his silk and he puts on his little wig like a barrister. Your Honor, how much more will this people betray you, Your Honor? Now is the time for your wrath and fury. You know, God sits as the judge, as it were, and he expects that God is going to come up with some kind of clever answer, which God always does, to save the Jewish people. What does God say, says Esther Rabbah? He said to the Sultan, you're right, go get me a scroll and I'll write down a deed for their destruction right now. Even the Sultan was shocked. That's not how God does business. It's like the Sultan did too good a job. You know, this QC barrister who's prosecuting is used to God saying, find me a way that the Jews can get out. But it's his job to prosecute the Jews. Here he is, Your Honor. The Jews have disobeyed you again. Indeed, you're right. Let's kill them all on one day. Get me a paper. I'll sign it now. That happened in heaven. Even the Sultan was like, really? Is that what we're going to do? God says, yeah, that's what we're going to do. Give me the paper, I'll sign it. You've got to understand, this was a shock even for the based in Shalmala. That's not how God usually does business. He usually finds such schus to save Klal Yisrael. They'll say, yeah, you're right, actually, it's a good point. Let's get them all. Eliyahu was so shocked in Shemaim, he immediately went to the Avos. When he heard what was going on, it was panic stations in heaven. Panic stations. Eliyahu went to the Avos and tried to raise the fathers of the world. And he went to Avraham and Yitzhak and Yaakov. And he said, get up. He goes, you don't understand, Kadosh Baruch Hu's going to kill your children. And they all asked, why? Why is he going to do that? He goes, it turns out they've all done Avodah Zarah. All of them? What's the din of an ir hanidachas? a city where the majority of people in that city all turn to idolatry in Israel. The din is everyone has to die by the edge of the sword. That's the din. So the Avos said, if it's true what you say, that they've all gone to avoid the Zorah, din of Ir HaNidachas. Kill them all. That's the Torah. What can we say against the Torah? Can you believe this is happening? Imagine Eliyahu is now mummish, panicked. We've got Elijah the prophet upstairs going, you've got to do something. He goes, what can we do? The decree has been set. What do you want us to do? You can think now how bad this is. Eliyahu, in a panic, was running about Shemaim and he found Moshe Rabbeinu. He found Moshe Rabbeinu. And he ran up to Moshe. The ultimate, remember, Moshe Rabbeinu's seen this before. At the sin of the golden calf, God said to Moses outright, leave me now and I will destroy all of them and make a nation out of you. And Moshe Rabbeinu stepped in the breach and said, look, this is... And what was it? It was a void of Zorah, I'd like to point out. They were bound down to an idol. We've seen this before at Mount Sinai. Moses stepped in the breach, saved all Klal Israel. Eliyahu knows the greatest person to help now is going to be Moshe Rabbeinu. He's literally seen this problem off once before. So he gets to Moshe Rabbeinu and he explains, Avraham, Isaac, and Yaakov, they ain't involved. I don't know who we're going to call in. Moshe Rabbeinu asked Eliyahu HaNavi whether or not the writ which Hashem had written in the tribunal was sealed in blood or not. That was key for him to find out. And Eliyahu HaNavi told him, no, it wasn't. See, he said, find a tzaddik down on earth. Who's the tzaddik on earth right now? He said, there's a guy down there called Mordechai. He said, go to Mordechai and let him pray from his end downstairs. And Moshe Rabbeinu will pray from his end upstairs. He says, because the deed is not sealed in blood, we've got a chance. Someone of note on earth has to put in tefillahs. I will do my bit upstairs. And together we've got a chance. I'm talking like the skin of our teeth. We got a chance. This is what it means. If you look in Esther 4:1, chapter 4, verse 1. And Mordechai knew of all that had happened. Now you read that poshut pashat, it means he's just up to date in the Esther story. He's following along like you are in shul. He's like, where are we in the story? Oh yeah, Vashti's going to have Esther, yeah. And he knows all that. No. What does it mean, says the Medrash Rabbah? He knew of all that was going on in Shemaim. He was fully up to date. No wonder he was walking around the street screaming. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai still says, it was the idol in Nebuchadnezzar's time. And the Talmidim say, no, it was the drinking of the Avodah Zorah wine in the feast. So Rav Shimon's disciples conclude that the Jews of that generation at the time of Mordechai and Esther were destined to be destroyed. And Mordechai knew of all that had transpired, i.e. that God had found them wanting. That's why they said to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, why were the Jews of that generation deserving of annihilation? They've already made the decision that they were. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai never said they were. He said, why did Purim happen? They said, why were the Jews of that time deserving of annihilation? We've decided they were. They had no doubt that they were going to die, the Jews of that time. They were now looking for the reason. And by saying that it was the Jews of that generation, Mordechai and Esther, they were rejecting their Rebbe, who said it was the Jews of the generation three generations ago who were bound down to the idol. He said, we're not talking about those Jews, we're talking about these Jews in the time of Mordechai and Esther. I'm telling you, says the Talmidim to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, those Jews at that time were deserving of destruction. So therefore, what was it that was the trigger? That's what they were asking their Rebbe. The Rebbe didn't even hold of this. The Rebbe was holding of Nebuchadnezzar's time. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, though, still held that it was to do with the idol of Nebuchadnezzar's time. Rabbis and ladies and gentlemen that are listening, remember Nebuchadnezzar was the grandfather of Vashti. Let's not forget this. She was a hangover from that generation where the Jews had sinned. Her father was Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar had a daughter who was Vashti. And Ahasuerus was merely the stable boy to those kings. He looked after the horses. He married her and married into monarchy. Don't forget that. This is all to do with Vashti. Let's not... Rav Shimon was saying like this. When you turn round to me and say, why were the Jews of that generation so surely going to be annihilated? You're clearly not holding of my view that it was actually at the time of Nebuchadnezzar. You're assuming that the decree is a fact. You've decided they were slated for annihilation anyway. So why ask me any questions? You tell me, he said. That's not my view. The disciples answered him. The Talmidim said to him, Rebbe, it's because they benefited from the wine. That's why they all had to be annihilated. So if Shimon says, you're all wrong. You're all wrong. This is Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, author of the Zohar Kodesh. Okay, living in a cave with his son all those years. Yeah, it's Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. And he says like this, your whole assumption is invalid. You can't say all the sins that the people have committed throughout the world, combined with the sin of the feast, resulted in a verdict of annihilation against the entire jury. You can't say that. Even if you were to find sinners throughout the world, only those who lived in Shushan deserved death, while the Jews in the rest of the world, although guilty of other sins, should have been free of the death penalty and shouldn't have been affected by this Holocaust. Why did every single Jew everywhere have to die? The students understand Rav Shimon says, so they say back to him, so you tell us the reason. If it's not for drinking wine at the feast, 18,500 people drinking wine at the feast, what is it? He said, it's because they bowed down to the idol in Nebuchadnezzar's time. But the Talmudim said, if that's so, then it's favoritism. How did they merit being saved by a miracle? If the Jews repented for their sin and were saved, then the Talmudim would not consider that favoritism. But it seems when they went and drank idolatrous wine at Haman's feast, they hadn't done tshuva, therefore God showing them favoritism by not killing them. The Jews merited a great miracle at the time of Esther and Mordechai. Apart from their salvation, it wasn't as if they were just saved, Rabbi Sai. Everything in the world was turned around. The entire situation was turned around. Everything was a reversal. They ended up dominating their enemies. Their very enemy became their benefactor. The very woman who wanted them killed was killed and replaced by one of their own. The whole thing was a turnabout. Ahasuerus now became the friend of the Jews. Haman was hanged. They became the upper hand. The whole thing was crazily miraculous within days. That's a miracle. The reason for their punishment was the lesser crime of benefiting from the feast, because the rest of the world had not sinned. That's why Rashi speaks of them meriting a miracle in the Gemara Megillah when he talks about Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, and he says they merited a miracle rather than saying they were saved. What's going on? Where Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says they, when they were bowing down, they were only acting as if they were bowing down. They weren't really bowing down. Therefore, they were not really sentenced to annihilation. The whole thing looked like it to heaven. But just like the Jews looked like they were doing avodah zarah, deep down it was nothing. It just caused fear. Caused by fear. The Jews experienced so much grief and distress because God made it appear as if he wanted them destroyed, just like they appeared as if they were worshipping another God. Measure for measure. Now, You should know I have an inner fear about giving these shirim, because if I get through the five megillas, I'm going to have to do eicha. And I'm terrified of doing eicha because it's so hard going and it's so intense. You'll all run away going, nobody wants to hear this stuff because it's so sad. So I don't want to do eicha because I'm scared to do eicha. I'm scared to do it because you're going, every pasuk is worse than the last one. You'd be like, no, running away, like, let's learn kinnus. You know, like, who wants to do that? But Rabboisai, I've got to give you a pasuk from Eicha. I've got to give you something from Eicha. If you've got an Eicha, if you've got a Lamentations there, I don't know if you got one, but if you turn to chapter 3, verse 33, that's Gimel, Lamed Gimel. This is the key to Purim. This is Eicha, Lamentations 3:33. Ki loy ina meliboy. Notice the word meliboy, from his heart. We're going to learn Haman thought to himself in his heart, who would the king want to give honor to more than me? You should get a nice horse and a crown and all these things. He said meliboy. Esav thought to himself in his heart, once my father's perished, I'll kill Yaakov, for he stole my brochas. Rivka found out about that, told Yaakov to run away. It's all in his heart. Look at Lamentations 3:33. Ki loy ina meliboy. He does not, God does not afflict Israel in his heart. Notice, we're going to see with Vashti, Ahasuerus killed her on a whim of his heart. Vayage b'nei ish. Does he grieve the children of man as if unnecessarily? Jeremiah, literally lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, says, you think this is all happening because God's just stum angry with you? God's sole intention is only to bestow of his good. Anyone that's done the Derech Hashem course knows the reason God created the universe was to bestow of his good to another. That's all he wants to do. And we don't know why he wants to do it. We just know he wants to do it. He's not cruel. He's loving. When he does afflict, and believe me, the Holocaust that happened at the time of Jeremiah under the hand of Nebuchadnezzar was horrendous. He always seeks counsel with his heavenly court. Notice, when Ahasuerus ordered Vashti to come naked in front of him, he didn't ask any counsel. He just had an urge for it in his heart. We're going to learn out a big difference between Hashem's doing something and humans doing something. He always asks the heavenly court, even before he made humans. Does the Torah not say, let us make man? And do we not learn out he asked counsel? And everyone's like, why would he need to ask anyone? Anytime God does an important thing, he asks counsel to teach us. Anytime you do something important, always ask counsel, even from those of a lower stature. If God was willing to ask the angels who are of a lower stature than him about making humanity, all the more so you should ask people before a major project comes in, even if they're of a lower stature than you. Ask advice. It's the right thing to do. He's teaching us something. He doesn't just go making a Holocaust on earth without taking Eitzah. Not that he needs it, but it's a thought out, deliberated decision. Not the whim of his heart, as it were. Don't assume that when God brings pain to cleanse sin, it's not for the benefit of the sinner, but for his purpose of exacting some kind of revenge or malice. God's not cruel. He's not punishing us because he's mean. It's like the retribution of a loving father. Sometimes a father has to give the son a patch because the son's naughty. It's not because he hates the son, it's because he loves the son. Now, what is revenge? Rabboisai, what's revenge? Revenge is only real when a person takes it against someone more powerful than himself or someone of a similar stature. If I strike down my enemy in revenge, he's got to be within my grasp, right, to do that. But not by God, from a mere mortal. God's not taking revenge from humans. God's not got, no, you can't touch him. He's not doing revenge on you for being naughty. That would make God on the same level as you. Humans are nothing. God is everything. What significance has humanity got in front of God that God needs to consider us an enemy upon whom to take revenge? This verse, this pasuk in Eicha is telling us, does he grieve the children of man unnecessarily? Don't think he's some vengeful God that means to hurt you. The only reason he's doing anything is because he loves you and he wants to heal you. The only reason he's making this whole Megillah thing come about is not vengeance for you bowing down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar and he feels personally jilted by you and therefore he's going to skip you because you're... It's God we're talking about. You've got a problem of a hangover from sin that's going to act as a barrier between you and me. You know what? I'll give you a shake. I'll give you a shake. You go, you'll do tshuva. That'll remove the evil. And then we're back on a good relationship basis where you can approach me properly. I'm doing it as therapy. It's not malicious hatred. How could God make every man, woman, and the child paralyzed with fear? Because you needed it. That's all. He's going to give you the right medicine. That's all. God can cause distress even if he does not actually intend to destroy. What have we got from all this? Rabbis, Rabbitsons, don't forget. One is the idol of Nebuchadnezzar's time. Two is the sale of Joseph. Three is the feasting at the time of Haman Achashverosh. It's all a package. Now we can look at Pasuk Tes. With all this as a hakdoma, now we can, please God, approach the ninth verse of the first perek. Rabbis, you must look so closely at the first three words. Look at the first three words. Gam Vashti Hamalka. Also, Vashti the Queen. Turn to verse 12. What's happening in verse 12? For Tama'ain Hamalka Vashti. She refused. Queen Vashti. Rabbis, is she Vashti the Queen or is she Queen Vashti? Can you see this? From verses 9 through 11, she's Vashti the Queen. In verse 12, suddenly she's Queen Vashti. Ooh, what's going on there? We're now about to approach her as Vashti the Queen. But we've also got to hold in mind that she will be termed Queen Vashti. Quite a different title. Vashti the Queen is a very different title to Queen Vashti. Is everyone with me on this? With that in mind, let's look at this verse. Vashti the Queen also made a feast. Now, ladies and gentlemen, why did we say they made a feast anyway? Why did they make a feast anyway? They made a feast. The whole point of last week's shiur was they only made a feast to rip the Jews away from God. She also did one for the very same reason. She's part of the plot. But she did it, Mishtei Noshim. She made a ladies' event. It was a ladies-only event. And where did she do it? Why do we need to know where she did it? Beis HaMalchus. She did it in the palace. Rabbis, where was the feast that Haman and Ahasuerus organized? That was in the courtyard. That was outside where the Nochschleppers are, in the gardens. She did it in the palace. What's this telling you about how she sees herself versus her husband? My husband, the stable boy, may stay in the stables and entertain his guests. But I, as the queen, will throw the party in the palace. You see this? The men are outside. Haman and Ahasuerus had to do it outside. Vashti, excuse me, I'll do it in the palace, as befits a third generation royal. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot going on here. This is what's going to irk Ahasuerus to get her to strip off. He wants to prove himself as worthy in her eyes. She already is throwing the banquet in the palace. He doesn't get a chance to do that. Interesting, hey? We're all learning this out. And that was the royal house, look at this, Ashel HaMelech Ahasuerus, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Who belonged to who? Did she belong to Ahasuerus? Or did Ahasuerus belong to her? That's what we got to figure out here. Because that's going to be the key of understanding Ahasuerus' personality. Okay. We're learning a lot here. We've just said that if a child annoys a father might punish the child out of a sense of love and duty for the child's benefit. Now, what does a father do? Let's say a boy's naughty and you have to give the son a patch. Chas v'halil, it shouldn't happen, but chas v'halil, let's say you give the son a patch and he gets a bruise. He gets a bruise. You hit him so hard, he got a bruise. What do? You take him to the first aid box and you put a bandage on it. That's the way of people, right? First comes the affliction, then comes the cure. God knew he's going to give us a patch, and he's already setting the cure in place in the form of Vashti. Vashti's the bandage with which he will calm the wound of the whole worry of Purim. She's the bandage. Hashem showers us. Not only does he bring the remedy before the plague, but from the very place that you transgressed, Nebuchadnezzar and his idol, that's where he'll send the Redeemer. Vashti's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, whose idol you bowed to. Her now being ejected from the palace gives a room for Esther to enter. The very descendant of the man who got you in trouble will be your savior. Can you believe this? We rebelled against God at Ahasuerus' feast. It's true. But Vashti, the queen, also made a feast. And God put the idea into the king's head to bring Vashti before him in verse 11. When Vashti refused to listen to Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus put her to death. And that, of course, allows the door to be opened for Esther to arrive. And Esther is going to be the key to the redemption of the Jews and the repatriation of our sin of bowing down to the idol of Nebuchadnezzar's day to start with. Esther commanded us to fast for 3 days and 3 nights in order to counter the benefit we gained from the feast, right? And how do we counter the benefit we gained from the feast today? We actually feast ourselves, but this time for Hashem. By the way, the Eitz Chaim, the Sefer on Kabbalah, in the 8th chapter, points out who says fasting can atone for sin at all. Why should fasting atone for any sin ever? Why does Yom Kippur atone for anything? The answer the Kabbalah gives, the Ari HaKadosh gives, is the fact that fasting can atone for anything is because the first sin any human ever did was only through eating. Adam ate what he shouldn't have. Therefore, the concept of fasting was rooted in humanity as an ability to make amends at all. I'm back. Look at the superfluous words. Completely superfluous. If you delete these words, what would you lose? Asher lemelech Achashverosh. The last three words of the pasuk. Who needs them? Just say Vashti the queen also made a feast for the women in the royal house. What do I need to know? Who got the title deeds to the house? Who cares it belonged to Achashverosh? Who would you think it belongs to? You've got to understand, it says Vashti the queen and not Queen Vashti, which is again in verse 12, what doesn't fit. The intention of Chazal when they wrote this to teach a secret message to you is to say, look how conceited Vashti was. She shouldn't have held her feast in the woman's quarters. Sorry, shouldn't she have rather have been better to have held her feast in the women's quarters rather than in the palace? The Gemara in Megillah, Yud Beis, Amud Aleph, the same Gemara that I quoted you earlier, says, shouldn't it say in the woman's house? Not in the royal house. A woman does not receive a royal title from her father, but only from her husband. That's the din. You can be a princess, a daughter of a king, but if you want to be a queen, you've got to be married to the king or a queen in your own right. When her father, Belshazzar, was killed and the Chaldean kingdom was disintegrated, as God said it would be in Sefer Daniel, do you know what Vashti's status was? She was a penniless orphan. And her father's house was destroyed. She had nothing. She had no claim to anything. She was picked up and brought to kingship by Achashverosh. The only way she could receive a royal title now was through Achashverosh, who had managed to usurp the throne for himself. So she wants to say, look how great I am. I'm a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, I got news for you. You're also a daughter of Belshazzar, who's got nothing. You're a penniless nobody. You've married the king. You are what? Vashti, the queen of Achashverosh. But she acted pretentiously. Now that she has this status, she held the feast in the house, which was designated only for royalty, which she had lost. She's only got royalty now because of Achashverosh. Even the verse is telling us, it belonged to Achashverosh, not her. She should have made her party in the hall set aside for the women and known her place in all this. She wasn't as great as she thought herself to be because she was Vashti the queen, not Queen Vashti in her own right. That's why the title precedes his name. He's Melech Achashverosh, not Achashverosh HaMelech. If you're Achashverosh HaMelech, then you're not the real Melech. You've got to be the king, Achashverosh. Even before he was named Melech Achashverosh, he was of royal stock because he was heir apparent to his father's house. He was the son of Darius because the Yalkut on Esther says Darius killed Belshazzar and he was declared king over the kingdom of Chaldea. And Darius took Belshazzar's daughter Vashti as a wife for his son. So Achashverosh was son of Darius, and Darius sacked Chaldea. So Vashti was a nobody. The only claim to royalty Vashti has is Achashverosh. She's Vashti the queen, not Queen Vashti. But she's acting with all the haughtiness as if she herself was a queen independent of Ahasuerus, which isn't true. Her haughtiness will be her undoing. This is what's indicated that her feast was similar to that of Ahasuerus's in quality and quantity. It lasted 7 days like his did. And she also invited all the ministers' wives, just as he had invited the ministers. And she told Ahasuerus that if the ministers rebel against him, their wives could be held hostage under pain of death. So Vashti's feast resembled Ahasuerus's banquet in that she also invited the Jewish women and tried to lead them to sin in a similar manner that the women were brought in front of the men. She went in front of the women. And she got them to drink wine. And she got them to eat treif. Everything Ahasuerus and Haman are doing for the men in the courtyard, she's doing for the women in the palace. She feels as if she's an even Stephen to Ahasuerus. But she isn't. She's merely the girl Ahasuerus' father picked for Ahasuerus. That's all. We're on verse Yud, Pasuk Yud. Bayom HaShvi, on the seventh day of this banquet, this is the second group of banquets. The first banquet lasted 180 days, where Ahasuerus wanted to show off to all the ministers. Then he's got the Jewish banquet, right? On the seventh day, when the king was feeling good from the wine, notice, Ki Tov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin. Again, this Lev, this heart comes into it. This concept of emotion comes into it. He was feeling good emotionally. What did he do? He ordered Mehuman, Bizusa, Charvona, Bigso, and Avgoso, and Zesar, and Charkas, who were these chamberlains who attended before the king Ahasuerus. Very interesting verse. Why are we being told of the chamberlains' names? This verse is only here to show the Jews how foolish Ahasuerus was. And it had to be written very carefully because, as we said in the first of these Shirim, Ahasuerus read this. And he was a fool. But if you write it openly that he was an idiot, he'd have been very, very angry and possibly killed the Jews. So he had to write in a code what was going on so that anyone who reads closely understands exactly what was going on with Ahasuerus. But if you read it cursorily, it doesn't seem to be anything bad specific against Ahasuerus. He did not make this mistake because he was drunk. Rather, he was feeling good. Ki Tov Lev HaMelech. He wasn't shikha. He was happy. And he ordered to bring Vashti the queen. This was his biggest mistake, especially in light of the fact that Ahasuerus ordered Vashti to strip off her clothes and parade naked, as on the day she was born, the Gemara Megillah Yud Beis on Beis says, she couldn't wear anything but the crown, had to parade in front of these ministers, these chamberlains, who he's now listing. Notice, by the way, normal sneers, even for any woman, let alone a queen, ask any woman to do this, any woman who feels dignified in herself would immediately reject such a stupid offer. Let alone a woman who sees herself as the rightful empress of the world and her husband as a two-bit horse stable boy. What did he think she's going to do? What an idiot would ask a woman who's so haughty that she kicked her own husband, the king, out in the garden while she took over the palace. You think she's just going to acquiesce to such a statement? How dare this stable boy ask me to demean myself? The more notable a woman sees herself as, the more sneer she is. The queen is a sneer-dressed woman because she has self-worth. She was very upset with Kate Middleton's original dress when she married her grandson. Said, that's not the way we dress. What do you think this is? You're going to be the queen. You can't dress like that. The more a woman values herself, the more she'll dress with sneers. Vashti valued herself so haughtily, she thought she was the empress of the world. What was he thinking? What on earth was he thinking, telling her to do this? Esther Rabba, Medrash Rabba, Yud Gimel, 10:3. Notice, 6:6, go to 6:6. Go to Esther 6:6. What I said to you earlier about this thing. Chapter 6, verse 6. He couldn't sleep at night, Achashverosh, and he got Haman's sons to read him the book, and they said, oh, there's this guy called Mordechai, and he saved you for big son of Seresh. Has anything been done for him? No, nothing's been done. And in verse 6:6, what does it say? When Haman came in, the king said to him, what should be done for the man whom the king especially wants to honor? Right? Now Haman said to himself in his heart, bully boy, who would the king want to honor except for me? I've got to be the source of this amazing honor, right? He said it in his heart. It was an emotional response. It wasn't thought out. And he didn't ask, may I please ask, who is it the king wants to honor that will better allow me to understand how to answer the question? That would be a wise way to answer that question. He immediately blurted out, I should give him X, Y, and Z, because really you must be wanting to honor me. Idiot, you didn't ask counsel. You should have said, who is it the king wants to honor? Let me think about this. Asav. I said to you, Asav, in Chof Zion, Mem Aleph, that's 27:41, said, oh, I'll say in my heart, I'll kill Yaakov and feel good about it. Yeravam, the king, said in his heart, in Melochim Aleph, Yud Beis Chof Vov, that's Kings 1:12:26. He said in his heart, it's going to be okay. All these things led to bad. Notice there is someone who said in his heart, notice if you go to, interestingly, if you go to Bereshis Ches Chof Aleph, it said, and God said to his own heart. There is one place where it talks about God talking to his heart in the Torah, as it were. Not that he has a physical heart. It means his inner core. He doesn't have an inner core. He doesn't have an in and outside. But his most precious idea of his relationship to the world, as it were. Of course, he doesn't have physical organs. Let's try to understand something. Whenever someone wicked says something in their heart, Haman, Esav, Jeroboam, Achashverosh, it's always that they're succumbing to their emotional whims. Against their own sechel, against their own intellect. And later, they'll always regret the action. Esav finally met Yaakov, and he wept on his shoulder. And they realize, Limafreya, retroactively, after the fact, that what they did was originally wrong. But if a sinful thought enters a righteous person's head, they'll do everything they can to oppose it. And they work it out. They don't just go along with their whims. They don't act rash and impulsively. That's a very negative midah. As soon as the king was feeling good from the wine, he immediately was lured into ordering Mamuhan to bring Vashti. Get all the chamberlains, bring Vashti. Yeah, I feel good about myself. Hey, go get her. You need to think this one through. He didn't. As soon as he felt good, that's when he acted. He didn't think it through. He didn't even appraise whether what he was doing was right or wrong, and how she'd respond, and how that would make him look. Indeed, she made him look a fool. She said, forget it, I'm not going to go there. So much so, he issued an edict that all men shouldn't be fools in their wives' eyes. Ridiculous thing. He didn't consult with his advisors. He just immediately ordered everyone to pick Vashti up from the woman's feast and bring her to him naked. Look at Yud Aleph. To bring Vashti Hamalka Lifnei Hamelech. To bring Vashti the queen in front of the king. Bekesa Malchus. Wearing the crown and nothing else. To show the people and the ministers her beauty. Ki tovas marehi, because she was She was fair looking. Her appearance was fair. A crazy thing to do to a woman who thinks he's a nobody. There's so much to learn from this pasuk. Notice again it says Vashti Hamalka, which means what? Her queenness is nothing but her marriage to him. He's establishing his rights over her to summon her as he wishes, whenever he wishes, as befits the king and her, nothing more than anything. She doesn't see herself like that. She's not like some pup that he can just order about. She's Hamalka Vashti in her own eyes. She's Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. She's Belshazzar's daughter. She's from kings. She doesn't do what you tell him. Say Chazal, the king suspected that Vashti was probably going to refuse this. And she'd claim that she was a queen in her own right and a daughter of kings. And that's why the Gemara says in Megillah, Yud Beis Amud Beis, Vashti said, I am a queen and a daughter of great kings, Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, while he is just my father's stable hand. That's what she said to herself, even though she was a penniless pauper who was picked up by Ahasuerus, by Belshazzar, who married into Ahasuerus, right? To Darius, picked her up. Now, Ahasuerus was happy when he reminded himself that he was a king in his own right, and he could call her Vashti Hamalka, not Hamalka Vashti. He wanted to feel good about himself. It's all about his own ego. I'm a king. She's a nobody. She'll do what I want. I feel good from wine. I feel now's the time to put my foot down with her. She's a difficult lady to marry. She's the kind of woman that's got airs and graces. But you know what? I'm feeling good. Now's a good time. Let's go get her. That's why the Yalkut Shmoni on Esther says that he called her as her Vashti Hamalka, specifically to say she's a nobody. Remind that woman that she's only got what she's got because of me. That's what he was feeling in his heart. That's the Yalkut that says that. Amazing. That's why it says to bring Vashti the queen. If Vashti's going to claim she comes from greater stock than Ahasuerus, you just remind her. That's what he's telling the chamberlains. She's going to tell you she's a queen in her own right. You remind her she's Vashti the queen, not Queen Vashti. She's only a queen because of me. You tell her that when you see her. And she can come out at my whim. Psh! That's what he was telling her. This sets the scene for a fickle man with ego issues who wants to impress upon his wife how great he is. And he's lubricated with alcohol. And he's following the whims of his desires left and right without thinking it through. And he ain't talking about it to anyone. That's great news for us. Because a man as fickle as that might be so fickle to turn back the decree of annihilation against us. He didn't think things through. He was a man completely ruled by his emotions and his feeling of self-worthlessness. He's a dangerous man. He's very difficult to predict, and he got angry very quickly over the slightest infraction. He's a dangerous person to do business with. That's exactly what God is using him for, to flit back and forth in decrees of annihilation and benevolence in order to be able to shake us free of the sin of Nebuchadnezzar. Be'ezus Hashem, next week, we're going to go into Vashti's argument with the chamberlains. When they walk in, she gives three arguments as to why she's not going to turn up. And in the pasuk we've just read, there's three answers that they answered her with to prove that her claim to kingship is nothing. And then we're going to see her rebuff when she actually finally refuses in Yud Beis, and she calls herself Hamalka Vashti. With all that you've said and all that you've said about how great you are, I'm still a queen in my own right. And that will lead to her death. Once she's dead, doors open for the beauty pageant. Once the doors open for the beauty pageant, Esther comes in. Once Esther comes in, God can use her, because now he can terrify Israel and use Esther to save us. And the only reason he wants to terrify or Klal Israel is because of Vashti's grandfather. Vashti's grandfather got us to do something terrifying, to bow down to an idol. We got to have that cleaned off. They're all puppets in God's hands, as it were. And we're going to see it play out in front of our eyes. It's unbelievable. Please, God, I look forward to joining you next time for our verse Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Beis, where we'll see how this all plays out. Thank you so much for taking out your time. And I look forward to seeing